This is a thesis work of my poor burdened graduate student Gordon Tam. This has grown a bit in terms of the collaboration. Juan Nino is on Gordon's thesis advising committee, and unlike in most cases, he's actually taken an active part in, and is now collaborating with us. And this is all about a puzzle that's been around a number of years, which we were trying to solve. And for those of you not experts in the alphabet soup of iron peptides, I'm going to call things that have one alkaline earth and two irons and two arsenics 1-2-2 structure. Okay, so this is all about exposing 1-2-2s, either barium or strontium or also calcium, to various species of reactive gases. Also, there's a Japanese work where they immerse these things in various kinds of alcohol, which is posted on many people's bulletin boards, red wine, soju, Yamazaki, single malt whiskey, etc. So we've discovered that if you do fluorine, you can actually make reproducible superconductivity. And I set the stage with this because this is an intertwined order, and I have no way to link the superconductivity with the spin density wave at 138 Kelvin, but I also don't know that it's not linked. So, and I found this slide sort of at the last minute. We've also done some aging work, which I won't talk about. My student is up to 224 samples at this point. Been working very hard. So the start of the puzzle was some work by Hosono's group back in the early days, where they were, because Hosono is in fact a thin film guy, they were working on thin films of 1-2-2 using strontium, and they discovered that when they they exposed it to air, they found that it went superconducting. And so they had a partial transition for just a couple hours exposure, and then afterwards at least 4 hours and upwards had this very sharp transition. And so they were sort of puzzled and spent a little effort, not a huge amount of effort, on trying to explain why. I don't think they got very far. But let's talk about what they did. So they were able to determine that it was in fact the water vapor in the air that was, because they could expose it to a dry atmosphere and not get the same effect. And so they're worried about various possibilities. Just to answer your question, is this a burning question in the field of iron pentoctides? The answer, no. It's probably very interesting, but because it's so hard to figure out, there haven't been a lot of people working in that area. So if you think about intercalation of, you know, stripping the hydrogen off, they also worried about putting, you know, doping with hydrogen. If you think about where that could sit, they looked at the structure. Here's your primer on how to look at 1-2-2s. It's got layers of the alkaline earth, in this case, of course, strontium. And then it's got the iron arsenic layer. Unfortunately, the colors in this stock are not going to be uniform, but this is their choice of colors. And so they just decided that there were two possible interstitial sites that one could think about, and their nomenclature is going to be different than our nomenclature later in the talk, for which I also apologize. But there's a site they denoted with the I-9 site in the arsenic plane, and they also denoted a site in the alkaline earth, or in this case, strontium. And they've drawn a green sphere to indicate the size of the interstitial site. So they thought maybe oxygen went in there, but then they decided at the end of their paper that it was in fact not the case based on their X-ray data. So they didn't really know. And later in the talk, we'll call the I-6 site the 2B site. So works related to the Hosono discovery work. This is the Japanese group that likes alcohol. lead guy appears to be Deguchi, but every once in a while Mizuguchi shows up as first author. So rather than the 1-2-2s, they were looking at the iron selenide, which probably all of you know that if you do iron 1 selenium 0.88 or something, you can get a 7 or 8 degree TC, and if you put pressure on it, you can get over 40. So they found that if they exposed this to air containing water vapor, they could get superconductivity. Now, of course, they're not going up to 22, because, of course, the 22 Kelvin is more or less in the 1-2-2s. It's the sign of what would happen if you doped with an electron donor like cobalt. Here, you're just getting the basic iron selenium of something like 8 degree TC. And you notice that the exposure as a function of time can be lengthy. I mean, you notice that the TC is still marching up and becoming somewhat sharper up to an exposure time of 110 days. So this is why we all have patient graduate students, so they can sit around and watch things change with time. So at the end, they considered all these things. They didn't really have microscopic data to determine what the answer was, and they did a follow-up work, and they, instead of just bathing the thing in various alcohols, they got a little more scientific and looked at the various acids that were in those liquids and discovered or decided or supposed that they were moving excess iron from the interlayer site, which is an answer that's only going to apply to the iron selenide and not to the 1-2-2. So it's not really germane for this work, but I thought I'd mention it. So if you were going to go investigate this, where would you go to look? Obviously, here's barium, here's iron, and here's the arsenic. So oxygen was one of the possibilities. Where would you go to look? Well, if you want reactive gases, you should go to the halogen column. So we started off with iodine. Iodine does not cause this effect. It's not reactive enough. We started then with bromine. Bromine, although it's very corrosive, also did not cause this effect. And again, as the electronegativities climb, we're expecting more. So chlorine. So as far as I know, no one else has done either chlorine or fluorine. And you see that you get, again, the approximate, and I'm calling it 22, and my office mate drawer said, well, is it really 22? Could it be 23? You know, that's plus or minus a degree or so. But I'm talking about the onset and or the midpoint. It's around 22. But you see, for chlorine, it's very broad. You have to heat it, because if you just do it at room temperature, it won't react. And you have to do a long time. So we weren't terribly interested in following this up, because that's a lot of work. But notice that this is quite broad, and that the approach of the resistivity to zero, where most people would start talking about superconductivity, takes a long time. So chlorine was not going to be on our list of things we wanted to do. So moving right along, fluorine. Well, we work in a hazardous materials environment in our laboratory, so we can do most anything we want to, as long as we are careful and write a how to do it description and get permission. So you see that if you take 5% fluorine, which is what the shipping companies will let you do without really horrible fees and special handling, if you do 5% fluorine in an inert gas and expose the sample to the fluorine, it's reproducible every time, each time, just 20 minutes at room temperature. Okay, and here again you see sort of, perhaps surprisingly, same as the TC for the water vapor, the same in the 1-2-2, the same as the TC onset for the chlorine. Fluorine also starts up here around the same point, somewhat narrow, and the approach of the resistivity to zero is much sharper. Now I'm not going into a lot of work for those of you who are iron pentoxide aficionados and experts. Speak.
These are bulk samples.
These are single crystal bulk samples. Hosono did films,
yeah,
which has its advantage, which we'll get to, We're doing flux grown single crystal mother, barium, iron 2, arsenic 2, not doped in any way.
Right, this curve looks quite nice, nicer than the ones you showed before. But the question, of course, arises, did you measure specifically whether that material is bulk superconducting?
This is not bulk. This is filamentary. Okay. We'll get into that. One of our frustrations is that, but in fact, all the evidences in all the other systems, it's the same. This is a filamentary effect. The water vapor, some other work we'll talk about, this is filamentary. Now, Hilbert raises a good point. He asked about specific heat. Well, that would be a bulk measurement. How about susceptibility? Some people, not us, see a diamagnetic shielding, not a flux expulsion. Let's be very careful here, but they see a shielding. We do not. We see no shielding. Okay? But I don't want to hide this from you, but I don't have time to talk about it. There's a large amount of work on the same effect at the same TC in 122 in as prepared crystals. You grow it out of the flux, flux independent apparently. You look at the crystals, and some of them superconduct for no good reason, even though you've kept it in a dry atmosphere. Okay? So, Paglioni discussed this work of his in the strontium 122. We also did the barium 122 with indium flux, with no reactive gas, with no exposure to water vapor. You can also just take it out of your growth crucible and separate it from the cell flux and or the flux, and you can find this superconductivity lying around once in a while. Paglioni found it in 90% of the crystals out of his batch. We find it in as grown this stuff about 1 in 20. So that means you have to characterize every crystal first before you do something to it, so that you can confidently say afterwards, what I did to it is what's causing the properties you see. Because once in a while you get unlucky and you take a crystal out of the growth crucible and you don't check it first and you find superconductivity, but it's because it was already there.
If you keep exposing it to fluorine gas, it eventually, what happens?
Turns to crap.
Okay, so it's
fluorine is very aggressive.
It's sucking like barium out, or it's just.
We'll get to that. Okay. That's an important question. What the heck is the fluorine doing? I mean, it could form barium fluorine too. I mean, fluorine will attack anything. Stainless, it will attack stainless steel. Again, I won't talk a whole lot about Jean-Pierre's work, but there's other work on this stuff. So here are the questions that I posed to Gordon when he started. We initially got all excited, and we thought we had Costa-Lastalis 2D superconductivity. We initially thought it was just a surface effect. It is not. We spent at least a year proving that. So how deep does the superconductivity go? Does it change the lattice? I mean, if it's going in interstitially or substitutionally, you might expect some change in the lattice. What about the carriers? What's happening in the Hall effect? This we got to rather recently. Where is the fluorine going in the lattice? And even more recently, we have some theorists trying to calculate where the fluorine might be going. Unfortunately, if there are any experimentalists besides Hilbert and I in here, you know this story. The problem when you involve theorists is they're busy disagreeing with what you thought before. So we'll get to the DFT calculations. Okay, so the answer, how deep is it? And this is very crude. We polish it, we do the resistivity, we polish it, we do the resistivity. And the resistivity superconductivity goes in 5 or 10 microns. Okay, so it's macroscopic, but it's not very deep. Any change in the lattice parameter? Well, Steve asked whether these were bulk samples. If we grind it up and only this small amount of the surface once we turn it into powder, that would be some very small fraction of the volume. If we grind it up, we don't really see anything in the x-rays because the fraction of the material that's been affected by the fluorine is very small. So what we can do is we can take single crystals and we can look at the x-rays in the c-axis direction, and we can see if the c-axis changed because we can get all the c-axis reflexes. The answer is no. There doesn't appear to be any change to a very precise answer in the c-axis. Don't know anything about the AB plane. Okay? Hall effect. This is why I'm presenting this talk to you. This is not a finished work. This is a work in progress. I'd like you to explain my Hall effect data. So, here we go. This is the concentration of electron carriers. This is the concentration of negative carriers. The mother, what we call the unattacked sample, are these. And so the concentration of negative carriers goes down when we affect it with fluorine. I don't show you a lower temperature than this because it goes superconducting and affects being able to measure the Hall effect in the fields we were using. But anyway, so it looks like we're hole doping it. We're putting in the most electronegative element in the periodic table, and we're hole doping. Think about that. Yeah?
I mean, this N is simply assuming that the whole constant is inverse of the N, number of carrier. I mean, it's related to a single band.
Yes, this is a simple picture.
Yeah, okay.
Single band, simple picture. And if it's multiple band, which of course the iron phenoxides are, it can get complicated. Yes?
Sorry, you pull a barium out, right? Isn't that consistent with holdover?
We'll get there. That was one of our early hopes. You keep asking questions that come in a few slides. You're a good predictor. No, you should keep doing that. It will introduce the slides quite well. Okay, so, and Laura is correct. This is simple-minded single band, which we all know not to do. So X-ray photo emission. This was actually, once we decided it wasn't costolustalis, this was what we sort of focused on. Because if we knew where the fluorine went, maybe we could say something about the mechanism. So, amongst all the experiments that Gordon did, this was the cleanest, straightforwardest. We like it a lot. It gave a clear, simple answer, which, for you theorists, is unusual when you're doing experimental physics on something you have no clue what's causing it. Okay? So, here are, and you've got to pay attention to the colors, the unattacked with fluorine is the blue. The attack with fluorine is sort of a rust red. And I'm not showing you the arsenic 4S, but it's similarly not there. So the arsenic 3D is more or less flat in the background and it's gone. It looks like we stripped the arsenic out. However, a caveat. While it's true that X-ray photo emission, the X-rays penetrate rather deeply, the electrons that get kicked out come out only from a shallow layer. So you're looking sort of at the surface. And I could show you more of the pattern, and you'd see that because there's oxygen and other things that are just surface effects. So at least towards the surface, the arsenic is missing. Very clean result. So that sort of matched, I shouldn't say our, that sort of matched my simple thinking. Usually in a materials lab there are two methods of thought. One side of the argument goes, I want to talk about the electronics of what we're doing, and the other side, which is my side, the simple-minded side, is I want to look at the size. So if I look at the size of everything in here, fluorine, you know, it could strip the barium out, but it's not likely to substitute for it. But in terms of size, the fluorine best approaches the arsenic. So, okay. So that was a clear result. At least near the surface, the arsenic 3D and 4S lines. So now let's talk about the calculations. And I promise to be quick, and I am. So this is... Simon Philpott's student Brian's way of looking at the structure, and it's slightly different, but this is the alkaline earth, in this case barium, and this is Tifa tetragonal structure. So he finds, in terms of his way of looking at things, three interstitial sites where things might go. Okay, and I won't bother you with trying to figure out what these are. He's looking at something in the alkaline earth plane for 2B, which, remember, way back in an earlier slide, I said, you know, we're going to call this 2B later. So that's one of Hosono's picked sites in the work he did 8 years ago. So the theorist will more enjoy this slide than I do. I had to think about it. But here are the various possibilities. Here are the three interstitials. Here are the three substitutionals. Let's not worry about this. But on the way to this, you get to here. So this is a range dictated by not knowing the chemical potential of the fluorine. But this is the answer for the energetics, this column here. And you notice that the most energetically favorable would be the 2B interstitial. And if you wanted to do substitutional, the barium would be the favorite. And in fact, barium versus, well, at least for one pick of the chemical potential for fluorine, barium versus the interstitial at the 2B site are not that different. From a size point of view, remembering that we don't get any C-axis change, if I'm going to stick something in there, I'd like to know what it did to the size of the lattice. And this is their calculation for how big the volume of the impurity would be to these six possibilities, three interstitial, three substitutional. And you see the smallest effect on the size of the lattice is, in fact, arsenic substitution. So that's not inconsistent with that picture. So what have we learned and what are the remaining questions? Well, what have we learned is in black. I know you're not all excited by this, but we at least chased down this road for a long time, hoping we discovered a sort of for free 2D system in a bulk piece of material that we could easily handle. I want to stress that we get around 22 Kelvin every time for 20 minutes at room temperature. This is not anything anyone has seen before. If you do water vapor, it's once in a while. If you do out of the flux, it's once in a while. Anything else you do, it's once in a while. Fluorine is bang, bang, bang every time. So if you want to work in this system, use fluorine, assuming your health and safety people don't throw up their arms and threaten you with being fired. We don't see, unlike some other people, any diamagnetic shielding. I'm glad they're not having the fire alarm in the afternoon. At least according to XPS, this is the case. And according to the calculations, at least for the impurity size, that could be consistent, which is from that slide. So what don't we understand? And of course, Laura points out that with not knowing specifics about the bands being involved, that's just to be expected. According to the calculations, arsenic substitution energetically is much less favorable than interstitial. So we have had these calculational collaborators for only a short time, so we're still getting used to each other. Don't know what's going on there. So the other holy grail of all of this work is what's causing the superconductivity. As I claim to my DOE monitor, this could be technologically useful. This is a thin film thing. You could be running a thin film of 1-2-2 through your reaction vessel, dope it with fluorine, and you can get a 22 superconducting ribbon, 22 Kelvin superconducting ribbon, by falling off a log. It's very simple, right? So it would be nice to understand what's causing the superconductivity. My office mate, while we were discussing this, Dror asked, well, what's going on with the spin density wave? Unfortunately, this is parallel resistivity channels. We have a surface that's been turned superconducting. We have a bulk part of the crystal that has the spin density wave in it. When we measure the resistivity of the whole thing, we're going to see the spin density wave still there, like I showed you in the second graph of the talk. But whether that's true for the surface or not, we don't know. If I were going to be talking about what causes superconductivity, since I come from the old A15 days, I would have been looking for charge doping. It can't be. It's the same thing every time, whether it's water vapor, whether it's chlorine, whether it's fluorine, whether it's long exposure, short exposure, unless the samples turn to dust from being attacked by fluorine. If you were charge doping, things ought to vary a little bit. It's always the same TC. Okay, so I really don't think it's charge doping. So, defect mechanism. This is another thing for the audience to chew on. Well, if you go back to the Paglioni group work published here, they came up with the idea that there was internal crystallographic strain which promoted the appearance of superconductivity. Our indium flux growth work and our annealing experiments disagree with that. When they anneal their samples, because in their minds they're thinking strain is causing this, they're quite happy with the result because in their samples, when you anneal it, TC goes away. Not true for us. When we anneal it, the TC is still there. So I have a little trouble with saying that that strain, but the strain might be very stubborn against annealing. Paul Chu, and he had trouble getting this published. This showed up in archive fairly early and took some years to show up in print, and it showed up in PhilMag. If anyone's an editor here for PhilMag, I apologize. But anyway, there's this big question in the community. Obviously, the Hosono and his water vapor and the 122s, that's sort of 22 Kelvin. That hasn't been a big focus. But the record TC by 11 Kelvin in the 122s is in calcium iron 2 arsenic 2, again, the 122 structure, doped with various rare earths, amongst them praseodymium. It's clearly filamentary. And this diamagnetic signal is measured in under 1 Gauss and goes away rather quickly, so it's AC susceptibility. This is a very weak amount of diamagnetic signal. It's doping independent, which is, again, the hallmark of what we're looking at. Doesn't matter how much fluorine you put in, how much chlorine, how long you expose it, whether it's water vapor, whatever, whatever. TC is the same, pretty much. So it's independent. So that's a sign, I think, that you can't talk about TC being a function of the carrier density. And Chu has this, whatever Hilbert's word was a while ago, hand-woven theory, which means an edifice that doesn't rest on a particularly broad base. He has this theory that it has to do with interfaces and strains and defects. So I'm just throwing this out as a possibility. I don't know what causes the superconductivity. I'd love to know. What other possibilities for the mechanism? I'm certainly open to suggestions. Thank you very much.
Okay, good. We have plenty of time for questions or discussion.
I would like to make a comment, or actually a question rather, when you look at the doping
independence.
When you look at the doping independence, when you're with cobalt or whatever,
there's a dome.
There's a dome, and if you extrapolate that dome to zero doping, that gets to 20 Kelvin.
If depending on how you extrapolate, yes.
Yeah, roughly plus minus. But it really strikes me that you find, and other people found always this around 20 Kelvin, this zero.
I agree.
TC.
I agree. So what Hilbert's talking about, to do it visually, You know, here's TSDW, here's the dome, here's Cobalt X, if you will. This is TC, this is TSDW. And Hilbert's talking about doing something like that, right?
Oh yeah, actually taking the curve, I mean the maximum TC is not 20, but it levels off towards 20K.
So you're talking about doing this?
Yeah, roughly, yeah, well.
Something. By the way, we have 27.1 now. We have the best cobalt doped in the world. Just a small advertisement. But, yeah. Okay, thank you.
And the other point is, could it be that, you mentioned that you have orthorhombic, you have tetragonal phase, right?
Yes.
So could it be that you suppress the orthorhombic transition and thereby get TC?
Maybe.
So that would be, if whatever can do that, it's independent of chemistry and independent of any details.
So we'd have to do some surface measurement to try to figure out what the structure was. Well,
if it's on the surface, wouldn't the tetragonal distortion get conveyed from the bulk?
I don't know. I'm just thinking of something that is independent of the various alcohols or whatever you put in, and that would be the only that would be one possibility to have it independent of the chemical details.
Okay.
Is the change in the Hall number reproducible if you change the amount or temperature of fluorine or whatever? You said TC is reproducible, so what about the Hall?
That's a good question, which Gordon has to answer before he defends. He's just done the one measurement so far. There's a lot of backfilling in something like this to make sure it's reproducible.
Any other? Okay, so let's see. We have the second talk is scheduled for 2. I suppose we should take a coffee break or something, because there may be other people who want to join us at 2. I'm not sure. What do you?
My tendency is to go with it. Just
continue.
Continue.
Yeah. All right. Good. So thanks.